1 Kings. We're looking at chapters 5 and 6. And so chapters 1 and 2, it's the coronation. Solomon becomes king. Chapters 3 and 4, he prays and is anointed by the Lord to be king. And his first real act as king of Israel, he's going to build that temple. That's what chapters 5 and 6 are all about, is the building of the temple. And it struck me as I read these chapters how he has no trouble getting people to follow him. He had no problems getting work. And you'll say, well, yeah, he's the king. Like, what are they going to do? Say no? Sometimes they do. Sometimes they get all rank and rebellious and just say no and don't. But he didn't have any of these problems. He didn't have any problems working with any of the people around him. It turns out that Solomon, blessed with wisdom, turns out to be a pretty great leader. But does it all begin and end at wisdom, or is wisdom part of that leadership set? And it just struck me that there's a lot about Solomon that made him a great leader. And when you really kind of look at it, was he perfect? He was not perfect. In fact, the older he got, the less perfect he got. But he was a leader. Now, if you remember our former regional ministers, tragically he passed away a few years ago, but Jim Leverett, he did a doctor of ministry degree, and his thesis was leadership, and he was all about leadership, and he taught leadership at the seminary, and man, loved constitutions. In fact, at his funeral, Lyle Byer, the pastor at McKernan, said, "I don't know if there's a constitution in heaven, but there will be." Jim just loved this stuff, and he was all about leadership, all about leadership. And I remember taking one of those classes with him, and the quick question is, what is a leader? And it wasn't rocket science. You know what a leader is? It's somebody who leads. It's just the definition's right in the word. A leader is someone who leads. And if you're going to lead people, you got to know where you are, and you got to have an idea where you're going, don't you? Because you're trying to lead them somewhere. Now we have all those cliches. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And another fun saying about leadership is, if you're a leader and nobody's following, you're just going for a walk. Leaders are people who have followers, and leaders are people who know where they're going. There's a destination in mind. There's a place to where we're going. And so lots of ink has been spilled over the whole question of, okay, well, a leader leads, but how? How does a leader lead? It's not just where and who, but how does a leader lead? Where does the leader get the authority? Is it the authority of the office? Is it the strength of his character? And I think the difference between making people follow you or inspiring people to follow you really boils down to character. It really just boils down to character. And Solomon was a king who people wanted to follow and work with because he demonstrated great wisdom, and he demonstrated this through diplomacy. Now, the purpose of diplomacy is to advance a nation's interests peacefully without resorting to conflict. Solomon built on the relationship between his father and Hiram, who was the king of Tyre. And Tyre was an important port city on the Mediterranean. It was just north of Israel, and it was one of the chief cities of Phoenicia and one of Israel's friendly neighboring kingdoms. And who is Hiram? Well, king of Tyre. He'd been an ally and a friend of King David. He supplied all the materials and laborers to build David's palace, and we read about that in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Hiram sent his envoys to Solomon to pay his respects to the new king. Very diplomatic move. He's going to go see the son of his deceased friend. And Solomon needs Hiram. Solomon knows he needs Hiram because Hiram has something that Solomon needs and wants, and that's lumber. And not just lumber, like top-notch grade A lumber, the cedars of Lebanon. Verses 6 and 7, chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. Oh, hang on a sec. Where are my glasses? Oopsie. Now, therefore, command that the cedars of Lebanon be cut for me, and my servants will join your servants, and I will pay you for what your servant pay you for your servants such wages as you set. Tell me what I should pay them. I'll pay it. For you know that there is no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians. As soon as Hiram heard the words of Solomon, he rejoiced greatly and said, "Blessed be the Lord this day, who has given to David a wise son to be over this great people." One of the truly fascinating things about Scripture is the way people talk to each other. There is no one like the Sidonians who know how to cut lumber. No one. You're awesome. You're awesome sauce, Hiram. We love you. You're just the bestest ever. You know, and it's just funny. It's just funny the way people talk to each other. Like David, when he's in, like, Saul's hunting him, and he comes out and says, "Why are you hunting me? I am like a dead dog." It's like, huh? Like, ooh, that's kind of graphic. Have you ever seen a dead dog? Dead dog that's been out in the sun a little bit too long? Like, that's just icky imagery, isn't there? "Who am I? I'm but a dead dog. I'm a dog covered with fleas. I am nothing. I am worthless. I'm despicable. I'm to be..." They just talk in this flowery language, you know? Did you ever watch MASH? And, like, Klinger, he was Lebanese, and he was mad at somebody, you know? "May the flies of 1,000 camels inhabit your armpits." You know, like, just these types of things they would say to each other. Well, Solomon is like, it almost sounds or feels like brown nosing. It feels like he's sucking up quite a bit. And he doesn't need to. He's king of Israel. But he does. He speaks wisely to Hiram. And Hiram's willing now to work with him. He's willing to do whatever. He has, Solomon, this great panache for diplomacy. And it made me think of Henry Kissinger. Now, for anybody who's like doesn't remember the 70s, you're going to be going, "Who? What is his name? What a silly name." You should read up on Henry Kissinger. He was, controversial in a lot of respects, an interesting man to be sure. But you know what? This is from the Henry Kissinger website. Henry Kissinger was an advocate of a pragmatic approach to geopolitics known as realpolitik. Kissinger pioneered the policy of détente with the Soviet Union, orchestrated an opening of relations with China, engaged in shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East to end the Yom Kippur War, and he negotiated the Paris Peace Accords, which effectively ended the Vietnam War. That's not bad for 4 or 5 years of work, is it? And like, it's just incredible to me. Some of you might be American and have American roots, and maybe you know this better than I do. But I think to myself, like, read up on Henry Kissinger. Read his resume. Professor at Harvard for 12 years on this, that, and the other thing. The awards that he's won. He was in the military. He's won the most distinguished awards for foreign-born Americans. Like, now compare that to who's running the show now. Like, there's a long distance between those folks, hey? I'm old enough to remember when Ronald Reagan became president and was watching a pundit show, because we got two channels in the town that I grew up on, and if you were going to watch TV on Sunday morning, you were either watching a religious program, which held no interest for me, or you were watching some political show, and there's these pundits on, and Reagan had gotten elected, and somebody said, "So what do you think of Ronald Reagan?" And I remember the American pundit saying to the interviewer, "Well, he's no Pierre Trudeau, but he'll do." And it made me think, huh? Because I'm from the West, and we weren't big Trudeau fans. In fact, I lived in Salmon Arm, BC, when Pierre Elliott Trudeau flipped everybody the bird because they were out protesting the fact that in the midst of his big diatribes about energy conservation, he took his sons on a cross-Canada trip on the Sanford Fleming. One car. It was the whole back end of it was glass. They had a kitchen car. They had their own chef. It was obnoxious. Anyways, the good citizens of Salmon Arm went out to express their opinions, and Pierre came out on the deck of the Sanford Fleming and flipped everybody the bird. Well, somebody made a t-shirt out of that. And they sold so many of those t-shirts, we actually built the community center in Salmon Arm from the proceeds of that t-shirt alone. We had orders from Australia, you know? And like, so Pierre Trudeau, that's who you're holding up, but read his resume. Look at his education. Look at where he's been. You know, there are some pretty impressive people, and you need some pretty impressive people when you get into incredibly dicey situations and when diplomacy is required. But at one point, Henry Kissinger was voted by Americans as the most important person in the world. Diplomacy is of extreme value, and people who are good at diplomacy and people who are diplomatic are highly valued. It is a fantastic characteristic of leadership. Think of these scriptures, Proverbs 15 and verse 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Or Proverbs 25 and verse 15, with patience a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue will break a bone. In Judges 8, Gideon had enlisted people to help him in a battle, and one tribe, the Ephraimites, they didn't get to play along. He didn't include them. They were upset. They wanted to kill him. This is what Judges 8, verses 1 to 3 says. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, what is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you want to fight against Midian? And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, and this is one of those great Middle Eastern lines. And he says to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? And then their anger against him subsided when he said this. What am I compared to you? Look at your accomplishments compared to mine. I am nothing compared to you. Look at how great and amazing you are. I am but a child. You are a man. And they looked at him and said, yeah, you're right. And they went home happy. No fights, no wars, nobody died because he employed diplomacy. Now, for somebody for whom diplomacy has been of a slippery fish over the years, I'm more head down, horns forward kind, and that hasn't always worked out for me. But I see the value in it, and I'm trying to grow in it. And, you know, there's a difference, I think. You know, we talk about IQ, but there's also something called EQ. There's book smarts and there's people smarts. Wisdom's the path to peace, and diplomacy is the art of persuasion. So pursue peace and achieve your goals through kindness and respect. Listen and hear what isn't being said. Show respect and you'll see people open up to you and be willing to follow you. And wisdom just plays itself out in so many ways. But it's funny, hey, because you can meet somebody that is so smart, but they don't have the sense that God gave a stump, you know? And there's other people, they don't have a lot of highfalutin education, but man, they can figure things out. And you know, I spent 7 years living with farmers, and let me tell you right now, there ain't nothing simple about farmers. They are bright, they are creative, they're inventive, they're ingenious. And if you think they're simple folks, go and have lunch at their house and go and look at their libraries. Go look at what they've been reading. Go and listen to their music collections. You know? Like, it's pretty amazing. I mean, some of you have traveled to Rosebud Theater, this incredible institution in the prairies, and it's run by a fellow named Morris Ertman, who grew up at Wiesenthal Baptist Church, which is quite literally in the middle of nowhere. You will not find that church unless you're looking for it. In fact, we had people come out and look for the church and couldn't find it. You know, that's where Morris grew up, in the country. And you look at all the people some really famous, incredible people. And you know where they grew up? In the sticks, in the bush, in the woods. And they learned things. They learned things. I love Reader's Digest. I love Reader's Digest. And there was a quote in there from, I don't even know the fellow's name, but he'd been appointed, you know, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. And they said, you know, this is a significant step up from what you've been doing. How are you going to handle the workload, blah, blah, blah. And he said to the reporter, son, I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. Everything has seemed easy since then. You know, there's the book smarts, but there's also people smarts. My wife is the wisest person I know. She is my closest counselor and advisor. When I'm not sure about what to do, I say, Gabby, what do I do? How do I handle this? What do I say? And she consistently knows what to say, what not to say, when to speak, when not to speak. And I don't always listen to her, and usually to my own peril and regret. But man, does she know. Man, does she know. You know? And what humbles me about that is grade 12, I took history 12, geography 12, law 11, biology 12. Everything I took was an academic course. I had to write 7 provincial exams. Gabriella took English 12, like we all had to. And then she took sewing. And then she took graphic arts. And then she took arts A, arts B, arts C, sewing. And I'll tell you straight, she's just about the smartest person I know. And then people like Eddie Metke, who could just figure out how to modify John Deere tractor implements and sent them a sketch on a napkin with a note that said, I think this would work better. They sent him a letter and a check saying, thanks very much. Simple old farmer from Millet just outthought all the mechanical engineers at Dearborn, Illinois, or wherever John Deere sets up its shop. You know, there's wisdom, and there's insight, and there's diplomacy. And you see it working itself out further on, because part of the reason why people would follow Solomon was because he knew how to get the job done. You know, he had knowledge, he had ability, he knew how to allocate resources, and he honored his commitments. You know, go back to chapter 5, verses 9 and 12. You know, Hiram says, you shall meet my wishes by providing food for my household. So Hiram supplied Solomon with all the timber and cedar with all the timber of cedar and cypress that he desired. While Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household and 20,000 cores of beaten oil, Solomon gave this to Hiram year by year. And the Lord gave Solomon wisdom as he promised him. And there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty. Solomon never, ever welched on his deal. He was also, though he drafted 30,000 people into labor, he set it up so that they'd be 1 month on, 2 months off. Nobody had an issue going to work. It says he had 70,000 people who did forced labor. You know, these were human wheelbarrows. These are people that carried everything. There was more people that were involved in more ways. But he had all these people doing all this stuff for him, and there was never any hint of rebellion or griping while the temple was being built. You know, and you think, how did he do this all? Like, when you really survey Solomon, like, he was young, and his big skill set was wisdom. But that wisdom informed him how to do other things. And somebody might say, well, he wasn't good at this or he wasn't good at that. And you know, maybe he wasn't, but he knew how to get things done. You know, it's like that old line about the great football quarterback, now retired, but Tom Brady. And when he was young, you know, somebody went to his head coach, Bill Belichick, and said, you know, are you sure about this Tom Brady? Are you sure about him? You know, he doesn't have the strongest arm, and he can't run to save his life. He's not very mobile in the pocket. And Belichick says, yeah, you're right. You know, all he does is win football games. That's all he does. All he does is win football games. All he ever accomplished in his life was to win 7 Super Bowls. There are entire football organizations that have won at most six. Tom Brady, by himself, has won more Super Bowls than the Pittsburgh Steelers or the San Francisco 49ers or the Dallas Cowboys. Yeah, you're right. There's lots he's not good at. All he does is win football games. Solomon, he's young, he's this, he's that. Yeah, all he knows, all he's really got is wisdom. All he knows is how to do is work with people and keep peace and do massive building projects without anybody complaining, grumbling, rebelling, or revolting. It's just really something, isn't it? And you know, I talked about Eddie Metke a minute ago, but you know, like that wisdom extends to people's ability to do stuff. And as somebody who doesn't have any real ability to do anything mechanical per se, like I marvel at people who can. As somebody who never ever took an art class because in kindergarten, I got reprimanded for eating glue. Yes, I was one of them. And you will think to yourself, that explains a lot. But you know, you get the glue, you get the glitter, pretty soon it's everywhere, right? You know, it's just like, it wasn't my forte. It just wasn't gluing those popsicle sticks together. I didn't see the point. You know, macaroni is to be boiled and eaten with cheese, not glued onto construction paper. What's wrong with people? You know what I did like? I was good at that string art stuff. But you know, to be able to fashion things and make things, like I just marvel at sculptures like Michelangelo's David. Like, how many do-overs do you get on something like that? Like, and you're sculpting. It's not like you can just like, oh, I took off too much, let's glom that back on. No, you got to get it right the first time. And he did. We want you to paint the ceiling on this church here. Do you think you're up to the task? No do-overs. Get it right the first time. Everything to scale. Nobody gets small hands or big ears. Like, everything has to be perfect. No problem. And by the way, you have to do it on scaffolding, laying on your back. Okay. Who can do that? But you know, you look at back in the day. I mean, this is incredible to me. Exodus 35. Then Moses said to the people of Israel, "See, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God, with skill, with intelligence, with knowledge, and with all craftsmanship, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in cutting stones for setting, and in carving wood, for work in every skilled craft. And he has inspired him to teach both him and Aholiab, the son of somebody else, of the tribe of Dan, and he filled them with skill to do every sort of work done by an engraver or by a designer or by an embroiderer in blue and purple and scarlet yarns and fine twined linen or by a weaver, by any sort of workman or skilled desire." You know, God gives people wisdom and skill to do certain things for his purposes and his glory. You know who I marvel at? I marvel at Glenda Ward. I don't know if Glenda's still here. You hear Glenda play the piano, or our own dearly beloved Krista. You know, I watch you play. You got to use your hands and your feet. And when Ardith would do the organ, like both feet, both hands, everything's going. It's like, no, you know, I can't chew gum and tie my shoe at the same time. Like, how do people know what this hand's doing and this hand? They're not doing the same thing. What's wrong with you people? You have, like, divided brains. Like, how do you do that? And then you go on YouTube and you watch these people play for 35 minutes and they've got no sheet music. It's like, who are you? Who are you people? You know, it's like, there's a reason I do not cut diamonds. I would just mess it up and just bash it with a hammer. It's like, I have no patience for that stuff. And I've got big, clumsy hands. You do not want me performing your heart surgery. You don't. I don't fix watches. I don't. Don't you do construction? I do demolition. That's what I do. That's my skill set. Didn't you play football? My job was to stop the guy running at me. That was it. I didn't need to know anything beyond that. If you see a large, angry person coming at you, hit them. Okay, I can follow those instructions. But some of you are incredibly gifted, incredibly skilled. You're amazing at what you do. My good friend Bill Bruce will phone me up sometimes and explain to me what he's doing. I usually stop listening after about 20 seconds, like, whatever. No concept of what he's talking about. But God has blessed him with that ability, and it just strikes me how in churches God brings people together who have such a wide arrangement and assortment of abilities. You know, if you've been given an ability or a talent, I think you're obligated to share it. If you have a God-given ability, use it to the glory of God and the edification of the saints. And that's the whole point of spiritual gifts. You didn't get your spiritual gifts so you could be all shiny and cool and neato. You were given a gift to share with the congregation for the building up of the church. I am not the church treasurer for a reason. Largely, I'm the pastor, and it'd be a massive conflict in interest. Raises for everybody on the pastoral staff. You're the only one on the pastoral staff. Even better. More money for me. Let's write those checks. No. I still remember first church where I was the associate pastor. My eyes rolled into the back of my head when we got treasurer's reports. But they meant something to somebody because they all talked about it and read it and looked at it like those numbers meant something. It's like my greatest moment was going out to Wiesenthal and the treasurer stood up, and this was the treasurer's report. No exaggeration. Norman W. Ertman gets up and says, "We have X. We spent Y. We have Z left. Are there any questions?" No! I move this treasurer's report. He moved, or that was my speed. But there are people who are incredibly gifted with accounting. There's people who are incredibly gifted with mechanical stuff. There's people that are incredibly gifted with music. There's people who are just gifted teachers. You know, Norm, did you ever do children's ministry? No. One of my greatest accomplishments is that we raised 4 children and nobody phoned social services on us. Yes, that was a win. Me and children, I don't know. The older they get, the better I handle them. The little ones, I don't get them at all. I'd rather have a dog. You know, it's just little kids, I don't know, not my thing. But other people are so good with children, and I bless those people. And there's people in every church who just have wisdom and know what to do and when to do it. And they're able to get things done. And we follow those people. We follow those people. Moreover, Solomon was a king who people wanted to follow and work with because he was faithful. You know what the scriptures say? In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the 4th year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the 2nd month, he began to build the house of the Lord. You know what's fun about that verse? We can figure out when the Exodus happened, because we know that Solomon was sitting there about 967, 966 BCE, which puts the date of the Exodus at 1447 BC. They've been wanting this temple for a long time, and they never lost that vision. And David was given that vision, and yet he wasn't allowed to build the temple, but he's commissioned Solomon. Solomon's going to build the temple, and Solomon does. He's faithful to do what he's been tasked to do, what he's been called to do. He follows his father's instructions. He followed the blueprints to the letter. And faithfulness is critically important. It's a foundational quality of a leadership role. You know, it's often regarded as more valuable than raw talent or charisma because it establishes trust. It establishes consistency and reliability, and it's required for any long-term success. It acts as a qualifier for leadership, indicating that a person is trustworthy and committed. You think about how important faithfulness, fidelity, you think about wedding vows. One of my favorite books on pastoral theology is called The Contemplative Pastor. And in it, Eugene Peterson writes, the word adulterous, or the word busy goes with the word pastor, like the word adulterous goes with the word wife. Nobody wants an adulterous wife. Nobody wants an adulterous husband. We value fidelity. It's just written right into those marriage vows. isn't it? It's something we count on. I mean, once the trust is gone, everything's gone, isn't it? It all falls apart. I think it's a fascinating passage, Luke 16, the parable of the dishonest manager. But in that, you know, you find out that this guy, he was about to get fired, so he fixes the books and he gains a lot of friends. And Jesus actually praises him. He says, "One who is faithful in a very little, in a very little, is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Faithful with little, faithful with much. And if you're unfaithful with little, you'll be unfaithful with much. You are what you are. You know? You just are what you are. I had a great railroad story, but I'll save it for another day. You'll be faithful. If you're faithful with little, you'll be faithful with much. And this plays out in the context of money. But if you love money more than God, you've lost. You know? And if God can't trust you with little things, he can't trust you with big things. So don't get distracted by the things of this earth. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And all these other things will be added to you. They're paltry there. But really value the Lord. Be faithful. And this is one of the great difficulties for those of us in leadership is working with volunteers. You know, there's like this little four-letter acronym. It spells RAFT. But four qualities that we look for in volunteers: reliable, available, faithful, and teachable. Volunteers are no good if they just have too many other commitments. They don't have time. If somebody is just so arrogant that you can never tell them, coach them, instruct them, they're no good to you. If they're not faithful to the church, they're no good to you. And if you can't count on them to show up when they say they're going to show up, they're no good to you. And sometimes we work with imperfect volunteers because we have no other choice. But if you're going to step up and you're going to volunteer, show up when you say you're going to show up. Show up to meetings. Show up. Keep your promises. Meet your obligations. Fulfill your responsibilities. These are all aspects of leadership, and what makes people want to follow you is when you're faithful. And they speak to the fourth character or aspect of character, which is integrity. Solomon was a king who people wanted to follow and work with because he had integrity. Chapter 6 and verse 7, there's two passages on this point I want to share. When the house was built, it was with stone prepared at a quarry so that neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was being built. Why would the person writing this account take the time to add that detail? Why would that detail matter? But it does, doesn't it? And you know what? It goes all the way back to Exodus. It goes back to Exodus, and as an iron tool was thought to violate a holy structure, the dressing of the stone would have to be done at a quarry. And when they built altars back, like Exodus chapter 20, when Moses built that altar, he was to build it with stones that had not been struck by iron. And you wonder why, and there's all kinds of theories, but the one probably I liked the best was that iron tools are associated with warfare and bloodshed. And the absence of these tools symbolizes that the temple is a place of peace. It's a house for the name of the Lord. And it's built to bring reconciliation. But then there's this other passage at chapter 6, verse 11. "Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon concerning this house that you are building. If you will walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father. and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. Well, this is a reiteration of the Davidic covenant. And it's a warning because Solomon's already strayed off course. And this is a call to get back with the program. You know, don't stray anymore. Okay, you've messed up. Let's redeem this. Let's move on. Like remember that if you honor me, I will honor you. You know, the great businessman, entrepreneur, money guy in the States, Warren Buffett. This is again from Reader's Digest, but he famously said, there's three things that I look for in every employee: integrity, intelligence, and energy. But if you don't have the first one, the other two will kill you. And you know, I found that to be true working with associates. I've had a couple over the years that had no integrity. They were intelligent, they were energetic, they were visionaries, they had no integrity. And I got to tell you, those guys wore me out. They absolutely wore me out. Integrity is huge. It's absolutely huge. Romans 12 and verse 17 says, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. And you'll hear people say you shouldn't worry about what other people think. Well, to a degree, but make sure that when you conduct yourself, do what's right. Do what's honorable. Like, behave well. Behave like a Christian. Behave in a godly way. You know, we've all had moments where we've fallen short, and I'm sure that there's people who've witnessed me falling short. I find it an interesting experience when I find some of you falling short, like when I'm in a restaurant and you don't know I'm there and I'm listening to the way you're talking to the staff. That's happened. I thought, should I say something? Hard to know what to do in those moments sometimes. Do the right thing. But you know, like, you come back to the whole stones idea, and like, there's so much overlap and interplay with things. But we're the living stones. We are the stones that build the church. Jesus is the cornerstone, he's the foundation, and everything's built on him. But listen to these words from 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men, but in the sight of God chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And so there's two things at work with that whole idea of stones and integrity and everything else. That in the here and the now and the physical aspect, the building of the temple and the stones, there was integrity used in that. There was the honoring of Scripture. There was all of that. And that, I think, casts a shadow forward to us, that we are to be, we're to be those pure and holy stones, those big bricks that God uses to build his house, which is the church. You know, it's a thing that we say so much. I mean, the words have come out of my own mouth, but sometimes I hear it and sometimes I cringe. And you know what the big cringy thing is? Oh, we're so happy to be in the house of the Lord this morning. Do you know how wrong that is theologically? Do you know how off-center that is biblically? But we all say it, don't we? Oh, this is the house of the Lord. No, it's not. If you have a mirror, pull it out and look at it. And you will see the house of the Lord. Because you are where Christ dwells. Christ in me. The Spirit who lives in me. You know what this is? It's a building. It's a building and it's nothing more. It was built and it can burn. It's what we do here that makes it special. This building does not sanctify our activity. Our activity sanctifies this building, and we ought to get that straight. Shouldn't there be propriety in the sanctuary? Yeah, because it's where we worship God. But this room does not make our worship holy. Our worship makes this room holy. It does. Oh, it does. Make no mistake, this is just a building. But it's in this room that we worship God together collectively, corporately. And I've said this 100 times, if I've said it once, in a few minutes we're going to go downstairs. And that's where we do church. So if you've come to church today, you've come here and you've worshiped and you don't want to stay and you want to go, you know what, we're so happy that you are here. The church isn't something you go to. It's something that you're a part of. We are the church. We are the church. This is not the church. This is the building where the church gathers. Does that make sense? Solomon was a leader. Didn't have to tell anybody he was a leader. Everybody knew he was a leader. He was a king. That probably helped a lot. But you know, it's interesting, because every church I've been in, they've always had leaders. I remember Jim talking about the fact that every church has two power structures. There's the formal leadership, and then there's the informal leadership. There's the leaders we elect, but then there's the real leaders. There's the leaders everybody follows. Back at Wiesenthal, I used to joke that if I saw Arwen Adam and Norman Kern having a conversation in the parking lot, I knew that policy was being set. You know, and out at Parkland Baptist, George Cuff was the undisputed leader. And when I came here, it was Richard Garrett and Wes Wurstiek, and Richard hasn't been well for a long time, and his wife's passing has affected him deeply, and Wes has his health issues. And a day's coming where neither one of them will be with us. So who's going to emerge? Who's going to rise up? Who are the leaders of this church? Because I guess I am, because you hired me and you called me pastor. But I have absolutely no power or authority other than that which you give me. If you don't see the qualities of leadership that we've talked about in me, if you don't recognize any wisdom or ability or faithfulness or integrity, you're not going to follow me. You're not going to follow a single thing I say. You're not. And to be true, over the last 10 years, I've given certain people all kinds of opportunity to question some of those things in me and about me. But I just think it's fascinating, that whole idea of leadership and all the ink that gets spilled talking about leadership and how to be a leader and blah, 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 blah. It just reminds me of that old line from the actor Gregory Peck. Do you know about this one? Gregory Peck went to a restaurant opening in the Hollywood Hills. And there was a lineup to get into this restaurant. Like it was the place. And somebody recognized him and said, "Aren't you Gregory Peck, the famous movie star? Why don't you go up there and tell the maitre d' that you're a famous movie star?" Gregory Peck said, "Son, if I gotta tell him, I ain't one." If you gotta tell people you're the leader, you're probably not. Because we all know who the leaders are. Intuitively or otherwise, we know who the leaders are. But you know, John Maxwell, he talked about the 5 levels of leadership. You know, and the very base is position. You know, you're the leader because that's what your job title says you are. Why do people follow you? Because they have to. Why do people follow Solomon? He's a king. They had to. But then the 2nd level is permission. It's very relational. They follow you because they want to. They like you. They just like you. No, Norm's going this way. Let's go with Norm. No, that's nice. You know, it's relational. It's permission. They assent to follow you. But then the 3rd level's what Maxwell calls production. You get results. And this just really resonates with D personalities. I might not like you at all, but if you can get the job done, I'll follow you. You know, why do people want to play in Edmonton? Because they want to play with Connor McDavid. Why do they want to play with Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl? Because they win hockey games. Why do people want to play for the New England Patriots, because Tom Brady, all he does is win football games. You know, get the job done. But then Maxwell talks about people development. They follow you because they benefit from you, that being around you makes them better, and they intuit that. They understand that. They want to follow you because being with you elevates them. And then ultimately, there's the pinnacle of leadership. People follow you because of who you are, because they recognize something in you. They respect you. They follow you because of who you are. And yet we come back to that whole idea of what is the essence of leadership? Well, it's character. And character is it's demonstrated through the exercise of wisdom and ability and faithfulness and integrity. But you know, all this sermon, this great big long sermon, holy cow, this has been a long sermon. You should have packed the lunch. You know, I didn't preach this sermon to try to give you, you know, four essential steps of being a great leader. I wanted to set the entire platform to ask a very simple question. Why do you follow Jesus? Why do you follow Jesus? Because you have to. Because it's habit, something you've been told to do. It's so ingrained in you. You don't even know why you follow Jesus. No, you're supposed to. Okay? Because you want to. You like him. He's super nice. He's a nice guy. I'd like Jesus. Let's follow Jesus. He's a good guy. Good moral teacher. Swell. But I think the last three is where we start to really get to it. To get something from him. And you know what we want from him? What do we want from him? We want eternal life. We want salvation. We want to go to heaven. And he's got the keys. And he's going to get us in. That's why. But you know what the big problem with that is? It really stifles anybody from going any further. And as great and as much fruit was produced by those great tent meetings of the 20s and 30s and 40s where people walked the sawdust trail, I know more people than not who had this very transactional relationship with Jesus. I prayed to receive Christ as my Lord and Savior, and now I'm good. I don't need to go to church every week. I don't need to get involved. I certainly don't need to tithe. I don't need to sacrifice. I don't want to suffer. And if I do suffer, I'm going to question a lot of this, but I do want eternal life. So, yeah, okay, I'm a Christian. Are you? Are you actually? Or are you just somebody who signed a contract? Are you somebody who made a deal? How about this one? Because of what he can do for me. He can heal me. He can make me rich. He can lead me to my future spouse. He can just pave my way. And never mind heaven, I want to walk on those streets of gold now. Look at all the good things Jesus can do for me. And then we end up treating Jesus like an employee. Jesus, I need something. Yo, buddy, my friend is sick. My mom is sick. Somebody, you need to heal somebody. You do. And if you don't, I'm pulling out. Because you didn't show up when you said you were supposed to. And you know, it's at that level where we see people fall away from the faith completely. Because they had this transactional relationship beyond that of salvation. They had this idea that Jesus is there to do something for them. But what about that last level? You follow Jesus because of who he is. You follow Jesus because of who he is. And you know who he is? He's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He is the author of creation. He was there from the beginning. He is faithful and true and holy and righteous and demanding, and he won't make deals with you. He will say to you, you will follow me fully, deeply committed, despite circumstance, despite situation. You will follow me because of who I am. And understand this, a day is coming where there will be a great reckoning, and I will not fail and I will not falter, because I am the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And what I call forth from you is complete loyalty, devotion, and worship. Not because it gives you an emotional high. You will not come and worship me because you think there's some sort of financial gain. You will not come and serve me and worship me because you want to be famous or have your name in lights or your name on the marquee. You will follow me because of who I am. I am Jesus Christ, Son of God, second person of the Trinity. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and you will never see the Father without me. I will bring you before that throne of grace. I am the reason you can have confidence to pray. But yes, I will be your friend. And I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be your comforter, and I will be your peace. But make sure of this. This is not transactional. This is not quid pro quo, tit for tat. You will follow me because of me. And so without any collusion, I was struck by what you did this morning in your music. The song we sang. Because this is really how I wanted to close today. Revelation chapter 5. Why do we follow Jesus? Because then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went and he took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, 'Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals. For you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth.' And then I looked and I heard around the throne and the living creatures and the elders, the voice of many angels, numbering myriads of myriads and thousands, saying with a loud voice, 'Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing.' And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea, and all that is in them, saying, 'To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever.' And the four living creatures said, 'Amen.' And the elders fell down and worshiped." it is not wrong to follow Jesus because he saved your soul. Just the opposite. But don't let that be the end of it. Worship him for who he is. Be faithful to do that which he's called you to do. And more importantly, be faithful to be that which he's called you to be. To be people of character. And to walk with wisdom and insight and faithfulness and integrity. Because that, friends, is the picture of leadership we see in Jesus. And it's what he calls us to be. That we truly understand that the essence of leadership isn't charisma. It isn't power. It's character. Be people of character for the glory of God.